Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, April 17th, 2015. NBC News faces another big challenge to its credibility. We're rocking into this Friday podcast with music by our friend John Dist from Los Angeles. This one's called Redemption Song. Kind of getting his Ramones thing out. And before we get down to business here, John Dist sent me an email. It was kind of disgusting, actually. But before I get to that, he and his band are performing live Saturday night in Burbank. Yes, in beautiful downtown Burbank, live at the Park Bar and Grill. A late night 10 p.m. start for the set, and only $5 at the door. I want every Peter B. Collins listener in the Los Angeles area to head for Burbank Saturday night and tell John Dist I sent you, okay? Now to the email he sent. You may recall recently that Ed Snowden sat for the interview with John Oliver, and John Oliver reduced all of the issues about government surveillance to the privacy of dick pics. Well, I got one of the most disgusting dick pics from John Dist. And don't worry, it's not exposed genitalia. It's a picture of him in a t-shirt that says PNAC. Only John Dist's head has been photoshopped out and replaced by a dick. Dick Cheney. Thank you, John, and keep rocking. Well, as I mentioned in the headline, NBC has another serious challenge to its, air quotes, journalistic credibility. Its foreign correspondent superstar, Richard Engel, has rewritten his account of being kidnapped in Syria in December of 2012. Now, nobody really doubts that Richard Engel and a crew were kidnapped and held, and their lives were threatened, and Engel had to sit and recite their propaganda for a video. But when you look at the backstory, and you look at the way that NBC is trying to quietly correct the record without inviting a whole new Brian Williams-type scandal, well, I think it's going to blow up in their faces, collectively. And I've linked to two excellent accounts, breakdowns of this issue, in the show file for today's podcast. One is from RT, the television network. I think they did a good job. And Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, who I admire when he breaks down a story like this, has done an excellent job in a lengthy essay. I hope you'll read both. Now, Greenwald opens by providing some context about where we were in the fall of 2012. There was a lot of pressure on Obama coming from the Hillary Clinton faction to militarily get involved in Syria. And there were people like John McCain, who we're going to ding a little bit later, who were saying that we should have been arming the Free Syrian Army, which was and is largely a myth. That's what I've been saying for a long time, and Greenwald affirms that. So keep in mind that Richard Engel was essentially biased in favor of those who were fighting against the Assad government in Syria. And at the time he was in captivity, NBC was furiously trying to signal that Engel should be released because he's an opponent of the Assad government. Now, that's a bad position for a journalist to get into. But this sequence of events exposes a deep bias on the part of NBC News. Because what Richard Engel reported to his network's viewers and to the world in general through an article in Vanity Fair and other interviews that he did, he said that he had been kidnapped by a group. Here's a quote. I have a very good idea of who they were. This was a group known as the Shabiha, This is a government militia. These are people who are loyal to President Assad. They are Shiite. They are trained by Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They are allied with Hezbollah. Well, it turns out none of that is true. And it appears that this great globe-trotting journalist was deceived by his captors and by the people who rescued him. Because in a post at Vanity Fair and a separate post on the NBC News website on Thursday, following a lengthy article in the New York Times, Engel corrected the record. And he said that after being contacted by the New York Times, which uncovered information that suggested the kidnappers were not who they said they were, and that the Syrian rebels who rescued us had a relationship with the kidnappers, he was used as a pawn by the so-called Free Syrian Army, which was using a false flag kidnapping and rescue. Both elements were false flag, trying to blame the Assad government as a way to bring the United States into the conflict. And NBC executives knew that there were doubts about Engel's account at the very time that he was all over their networks explaining his personal account that we now know was not true. And Greenwald introduces me to, he describes him as the truly brilliant political science professor and blogger, Assad Abu Khalil. And Abu Khalil, on the very day, December 18th of 2012, that the Engel story went public, he published an email from a knowledgeable Western journalist pointing out numerous reasons to doubt that the kidnappers were aligned with Assad. He argued that the Engel abduction seems very much like a setup, like the kidnappers wanted him to think he was taken by Shiites. Abu Khalil examined the video and wrote, "I looked at the video and it is so clearly a setup, and the slogans are so clearly fake, and they intend to show that they were clearly Shiites and that they are savages. If this one is believable, then I am a dentist." And he adds, "I'm not saying that Engel was in on the plot. I think they were really kidnapped, but the kidnappers of the Free Syrian Army typically lied to them about their identity, and this has happened before." So Greenwald underscores that NBC officials knew at the time that there was reason to be skeptical of the identity of the captors, but nonetheless allowed Engel and numerous other NBC and MSNBC reporters to tell his story with virtually no questioning. This is where the deep bias of NBC comes into play. They were more interested in the optics of their liberated reporter telling his story about the evil Assad government because it fit with the narrative provided by the hawks in Washington. And you can see clearly that NBC aligned with them as opposed to saying, "Well, you know, it's an open question. We need to do more digging to find out who actually kidnapped our guy." And Richard Engel is a decent reporter, but he's captive to the corporate media environment. He uses his crayons always inside the lines, in my opinion. And so Engel has one other problem. And this is what moves into the Brian Williams category. Because in his recounting of his kidnapping and rescue, he stated that he saw one of his captors killed. But now he's walking that back. In his Vanity Fair article, Engel described one of his captors lying dead. In his statement Wednesday, he acknowledged that he did not see bodies during the rescue. Wow. So he's got the same inflated ego that leads to inflation and exaggeration and fabrication of personal daring do in a conflict zone. That's a virus. NBC's got it big time. We'll see what they do about it. Maybe they ought to get out of the news business. Also at The Intercept, I'm surprised to see that Trevor Aronson, who has been a guest on our program several times, an excellent journalist from Florida. He was working for Al Jazeera the last time I talked to him and doing excellent work there. Well, he's got a great profile at The Intercept today. I will link to it as well. Of one of the 15,000 domestic informants who are paid by the FBI to infiltrate Muslim communities and others, including so-called eco-terrorists, and set them up for criminal convictions. And he profiles a young man with a criminal rap sheet, and his name is Torres, Saeed Torres. And Torres has been featured in a new film that was just screened earlier this week called Terror. And they do a play on words where they put the letter T in parentheses to highlight the word error in the FBI's anti-terror investigations and prosecutions. So this guy Torres can make as much as $100,000 for a case that he works. He's a former Black Panther, a convict who robbed New York City transit booths, and he portrays himself as a radicalized Muslim when he is in character, and he says, I don't like the word informant. I consider myself a civilian operative. And in this account, Trevor Aronson mentions the case where Torres was the informant behind FBI stings that targeted a man named Tariq Shah, a Bronx jazz pianist who was convicted of providing material support in 2007 after he pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda in front of an undercover agent. And he is now serving a 15-year sentence. Now, I'd like to know more about Shah's case, and frankly, I don't. But based on this description here, if all he was convicted for was a pledge of allegiance, and he got a 15-year sentence? Wow, that is really shocking. And the article goes into more detail, you can read it yourself, about some of the Keystone Cops type situations that surface when these paid informants, who are not professionals, screw up, and it makes the FBI look like unprofessionals. And often they are. For example, in this case in Pittsburgh, where they send Torres to investigate and presumably frame a suspect, he is not willing to do it because he says this guy, he couldn't attack a grape or something like that. And so they brought in a second guy. And it turns out that he hands a business card to the suspect, who then Googles that guy's phone number, and it comes up in another FBI sting news case about the Newburgh Four. And so these FBI operatives and their minders don't even have the basic police skills, investigative skills to cover their tracks. Now we have a new case that surfaced in Ohio over the last couple of days. Turns out this guy's been back in the country for quite a while. His name is Abdurrahman Sheikh Mohammed, age 23. He's from the Columbus area. And his brother went to Syria and died fighting for the Al-Nusra Front in 2013. Abdurrahman made a trip to Syria and then came back. And the charges against him indicate that while he was in Syria, an unnamed cleric told him that when his training was completed that he shouldn't join the fighting there, but he should go home and carry out an act of terrorism. But this news account in the New York Times, in paragraph 5, notes this. Despite the alleged statements about his desire to carry out an attack, the indictment gives no indication that Mr. Muhammad did more than talk about it. Now, how different is that from the jazz pianist from the Bronx who pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda or Osama? These are thought crimes. These are speech crimes. And so this guy is being, I think, developed into the poster child for the threat that we were told about last summer, that the evildoers of the Islamic State, and in particular this cult group called the Khorasan Group, that they were actively planning to send jihadists back to the United States to conduct attacks here. And this is such a flimsy case. Now, I want to be clear, I see no indication of a paid FBI informant in this case. That's rare, it's different. But I also see a flimsy circumstantial case against a guy who put up Facebook posts in favor of the Islamic State. He clearly sympathizes with the other side. But let's remember that it was just a couple of years ago, going back to our opening story about Richard Engel and NBC, that it was okay for Americans to go to Syria and fight. They could join any group that was against the Assad government. It only became something that led to criminal charges in recent years. And so, by invoking the Khorasan group, my bullshit detector goes way up here. We'll continue to watch this case and offer any new information or analysis that comes to light. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Gunnar Gunderson just took out a new subscription, and Gunnar's been in the pack before, so maybe that's a second one. Thank you, Gunnar. Natalie Reel in Montana. Gary Kane just renewed his annual subscription. And Sally Soriano is a longtime monthly subscriber to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. I invite you to join them. I need you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, click on the sign-up link. That takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, that $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers get my bonus gift, an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. Well, today in an in-depth interview with Professor Graham McQueen from Canada, we go into detail about the 2001 anthrax attacks that followed the September 11 attacks with the October anthrax scare. And we discuss a lot of details about it. We put it into context related to 9/11 and seeking the truth about the events of September 11th and who caused them. And I'm really impressed with Professor McQueen. He wrote the book about the anthrax attacks. And since he published it, more than a dozen of my listeners, many of whom are subscribers, have said, "Hey, Peter, you ought to have Graham McQueen on the podcast." And so today I interviewed him because there is a new break in the story. One of the FBI agents who investigated the anthrax attacks, Richard Lambert, filed a lawsuit last week accusing the FBI of trying to railroad the prosecution of Dr. Bruce Ivins, who was kind of the third or fourth suspect that they focused in on, in a shifting and confusing investigation. And Professor McQueen makes the case that the anthrax attacks were directly linked to political pressure to pass the Patriot Act. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Graham McQueen.
And right toward the end of October, October 26th, George Bush signs the Patriot Act into law. In between there, you have the beginning of the bombing of Afghanistan, and you have the obvious intention that comes forward that the U.S. is going to also attack Iraq. And the anthrax attacks are used both for external purposes and internal. Externally, they are used to support the invasion of Afghanistan because they say Al-Qaeda did it. That was the earliest and strongest theory. Same people who did 9/11 did anthrax. Therefore, we're going after them in Afghanistan. And then the next theory came in right after that, which was that although Al-Qaeda, you know, wrote the letters and sent them, they got the anthrax from guess who? Iraq. So Iraq is the perpetrator. Now, I put these two together, and I call it the double perpetrator in the book. So what that means simply is that you have a state sponsor of the anthrax attacks, which is Iraq, and you have the foot soldiers, the people who actually do the work on the ground, and that's Al-Qaeda. Now, when you think about this double perpetrator, which was a hypothesis very strongly pushed in mid-October, right up to the period when the Patriot Act went through. Mm-hmm. Started to fall apart after that. But for a crucial period, this was a magnificent example of how you implicate the two countries you want to attack and how you get the Patriot Act through Congress, because the anthrax attacks were crucial to that.
I hope you'll listen to the full interview with Professor Graham McQueen. It's available for subscribers today at all of our distribution points, peterbcollins.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Zune, wherever else you can find it. There's a podcast site in Germany that posts our shows, so I hope you'll take a listen. Gareth Porter is the man who I respect most in analyzing the situation with Iran. And at truthout.org today, he has a great analytical piece that I'll post to for you. And the talks with Iran are supposed to resume next week. And Gareth Porter believes that the biggest stumbling block is going to be over the demand that Iran come clean about its past nuclear programs. And as you know, if you're a regular listener here, Gareth Porter argues that based on our own intelligence reports and on what we now know would have been exposed as Israeli efforts to falsely paint the Iranians with a nuclear, an active nuclear program, that this is going to be a real problem because the U.S. and the West, at the behest of Israel, are demanding that Iran expose things that don't exist, or that may not exist, I'll at least say that. And I hope you'll read the entire analytical article by Gareth Porter, because, for example, he says, the administration of George W. Bush pressed documents supposedly from the laptop computer of an Iranian scientist on the International Atomic Energy Agency in mid-2005. But the man who headed the agency at the time, Mohammad El-Baradei, refused to regard the documents as legitimate for very good reason. The problem was, quote, no one knew if any of this was real. But his successor, the more compliant Japanese diplomat Yukiya Amano, accepts the documents and has assured American officials that he is solidly in the U.S. court in his handling of the file. And Porter, in addition, quotes Robert Kelly, a former American member of the IAEA, and he said that one of the other allegations that was put forward by Israel was that Iran had installed a large steel explosives containment cylinder at the military base in Parchin. And Kelly dismissed it as simply technically implausible. And so there is this, you know, narrative, counter-narrative, and the consensus narrative is that Iran has always wanted a nuclear program and has been actively pursuing it. And Iran will now be put in the position of having to prove the negative in this case. Top American generals have expressed their concern about Saudi Arabia's intervention in Yemen. And the raving John McCain has accused the Obama administration of going soft on Iran's regional ambitions in pursuit of the deal with Iran, and has praised, quote, our Arab partners for intervening in Yemen. And here's the quote from McCain. The prospect of radical groups like Iran-backed Houthi militants was more than Arab allies could withstand. But a large contingent of U.S. senior military officials believe that the Saudi-led military operation will fail and possibly turn into a quagmire. Now, another quote from McCain, these countries led by Saudi Arabia did not notify us nor seek our coordination or our assistance in this effort because they believe we are siding with Iran. Well, that's bullshit. I mean, it just is. And as you know, I don't support the U.S. meddling in Yemen that's been going on since Obama became president in any way, shape, or form. But to say that the U.S. is siding with Iran, that really, you know, it gets into the Tom Cotton treason zone. So military sources scoff at this. The reason the Saudis didn't inform us is because they knew we would have told them exactly what we think, that it's a bad idea. The UN Security Council met on Thursday. They reviewed video and heard eyewitness testimony of chemical weapons use in the war in Syria. And this is such a maddening cycle, because the UN continually will acknowledge reports that chemical weapons have been used, but never, you know, really nail down who is responsible. Now here we see presented eyewitness testimony from Dr. Mohammed Tanari from the Syrian town of Sarmin, where in that region in March of this year, helicopters came up and dropped these barrel bombs. And they contained chlorine, apparently chlorine bleach or a chlorine liquid. And a number of people were killed. He had to go to his hospital, where more than 100 people showed up in very short order. He described the grisly deaths of 3 children and their parents and their grandmother. Now, this is very ugly. There is no question about it. And it affirms what Human Rights Watch has said it uncovered recently, that the Syrian government has used chlorine or other toxic chemicals in barrel bomb attacks in Idlib. That's in the same region, in the same time frame between, during the last 2 weeks of March. However, I have to say that having seen the orchestrated accounts back during the Gulf War of the Kuwaiti babies who were thrown out of incubators and the false nature of those accounts, they were flatly false. It leaves me skeptical of reports like this. Satellite imagery has been released showing that China is busy building a lengthy 10,000-foot runway on a contested island in the South China Sea. The location is Fiery Cross Reef, part of the Spratly Islands, and over the last decade, there have been a series of encounters between American and Chinese forces and Japanese claims. Others claim these islands as their territory. And I guess now we see why China was interested. Building this runway will certainly expand the reach of their surveillance and military operations potential in an effort to counter the U.S. shift toward Asia in recent years. Well, I'm pleased to see that a new group called the Civil Liberties Coalition has surfaced. And the Guardian newspaper wrote a story about this, quoting my good friend Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And as I've explained to you, with the Patriot Act expiring at the end of May, there's a scramble underway. The spooks were up on Capitol Hill giving secret briefings this week, trying to persuade particularly freshman members of the House that they really need to step up and renew the Patriot Act without any changes. And so the strategy is for the spook community, the surveillance state, to embrace the watered-down and discredited bill from last year, the so-called USA Freedom Act. About the only thing left in there is it would eliminate the metadata collection of U.S. phone records, right? And it wouldn't mean that they wouldn't be collected anymore. It would just kind of change the method. And the idea was that the phone companies would hold on to the data, and when the NSA sent them a warrant, they would release it. But still, the metadata will be collected and available as needed. Well, the Civil Liberties Coalition has announced that the USA Freedom Act is yesterday's news. And you're right about that, Shahid. You absolutely are. So they are rallying around the bill we've been talking about here, the Pocan-Massey bill, which is called the Surveillance State Repeal Act. And that's the one that we need to get people talking about, lobby our elected leaders to support. And I don't expect that it will pass unamended. But we can't allow the reform light and the illusion of reform in the USA Freedom Act to be the only reform that we get. And finally, today I'm chagrined to tell you that the heroic bystander who turned on his video camera and captured the murder of Walter Scott by police officer Michael Slager in North Charleston, South Carolina. This doesn't seem to be his own personal action, but lawyers who represent him have been sending cease and desist letters to media outlets, telling them that if they want to continue to play the video of the officer murdering the runaway unarmed black man, that they have to buy a license and pay $10,000 or more. Now, the man who shot the video is named Fidan Santana. He's an immigrant from the Dominican Republic, and I saw him interviewed, and it seemed like all of his intentions were headed in the right direction. But he lawyered up, and it turns out that his lawyer kind of did this without his direct knowledge or consent. And I hope that he can tell the lawyer to find somebody else to fleece. I guess that's the cleanest way out of that sentence that I just started. So thanks for listening all the way to the bitter end of my news and comment podcast. Have yourself a great weekend and share this with somebody if you will. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.